Go. Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the National Park Service Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River Superintendent, Lindsay Kernath, will be here to talk about the federal agency's near-term goals and objectives within the river corridor. Plus, we'll speak to friends of the Upper Delaware River about Riverfest, the second annual, celebrating all things Delaware River. Plus, Worship Live with James B. Huffington for local economic perspective. And live music at Harmony in the Woods continues in Hawley. We'll speak to the Lau Tizer Quartet about their upcoming concert. Plus, it's our summer fun drive. Donate now, 845-482-4141, or go to WJFFradio.org. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Hurricane Beryl roared ashore today on the coast of Texas. Its top sustained winds at landfall were 80 miles per hour. That's now dropped to about 75 miles per hour. Meteorologist Brian Jackson of the National Weather Service says the Houston area is getting the brunt of the storm now.
We're expecting all total over East Texas, 5 to 10 inches, a local maximum of 15. The storm is moving north, which is good that it's not going to stall over the same areas, but you got to move up into Arkansas over the next 24 hours.
The tracking site PowerOutage.us says 1.5 million customers in Texas are now without electricity. The storm is going to continue to lose strength as it barrels north. Flood watches are now posted as far north as southern Indiana. There's a different weather danger facing the U.S. today, powerful and dangerous heat. More than 140 million people are under heat alerts today. It's especially dangerous in the West, where excessive heat warnings are posted from Washington State to Arizona's border with Mexico. In a letter to congressional Democrats, President Biden says he is not bowing out of the race. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, this comes as Congress returns from recess with a growing number of members agitating for him to go.
In the letter, Biden again says he is firmly committed to staying in the race for president and beating Donald Trump. He says he has heard the concerns people have and, quote, good faith fears and worries about what's at stake in this election. He goes on to argue that pushing him out now would disenfranchise Democratic primary voters who overwhelmingly selected him. It was their decision to make, he says, quote, not the press, not the pundits, not the big donors. And Biden concludes saying this question has been well aired for more than a week now, and it is time for it to end. At this point, the ongoing debate only helps Trump, Biden writes. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Stocks opened higher this morning as aircraft maker Boeing strikes a plea agreement with the Justice Department. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 230 points in early trading.
Boeing shares, which are part of the Dow Index, got a lift from the news. The aircraft maker agreed to plead guilty to a criminal fraud charge stemming from the deadly crashes of two 737 MAX jets. Boeing agrees to pay a nearly $500 million fine and invest hundreds of millions of dollars more to improve safety. 3 years ago, the company struck a deal to avoid criminal prosecution, but the Justice Department says Boeing failed to live up to the conditions of that agreement. The parent company of Paramount Studios and CBS Television has agreed to merge with Skydance after a lengthy negotiation. Skydance is run by the son of billionaire Oracle founder Larry Ellison. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up about 220 points. You're listening to NPR. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban is on an unannounced visit to China. As NPR's John Ruwitch reports, his visit to Beijing follows recent stops in Moscow and Kyiv amid Russia's ongoing invasion of Ukraine.
Chinese state TV said Orban met Chinese leader Xi Jinping, although there were no details. Earlier on the social media platform X, Orban posted a picture of himself arriving in Beijing with the words Peace Mission 3.0. On July 6th, he posted Peace Mission Second Stop Moscow. And before that, he was in Kyiv for talks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. All of this comes after Hungary took over the rotating presidency of the European Union at the start of the month. Orban has said Hungary is one of the few countries that can still talk to all parties in the Ukraine conflict. China has been trying to position itself as a peace broker, too. In May, Xi visited Budapest, and the two countries elevated their ties to an all-weather comprehensive strategic partnership. John Ruich, NPR News, Beijing.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia has fired some 40 missiles into his country today. Several cities were hit, including the capital, Kyiv. At least 20 people have been killed. Zelensky says the Russians targeted residential buildings, infrastructure, and a children's hospital. The Ukrainian leader says people are still trapped under the rubble. Ukrainian officials say the Russians used fast-moving ballistic and cruise missiles. NASA has wrapped up a year-long experiment. It was to create a simulated environment in a compartment that astronauts might be in if they lived on Mars. Four crew members spent a year locked in the environment in Houston. They emerged over the weekend. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, not pressing the right button this morning. It's the first day of our summer fun drive. I'm a little distracted because we've gotten some donations coming through. Thanks to all the folks who donated so far to help us toward our $50,000 goal. We're about 13% of the way there, and we've just officially kicked that off this morning at 7. So good on you for donating early. Thank you so much if you've donated already. If you haven't, you can help us get to that goal quickly by calling us at 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. Again, our summer fun drive needs your support because we're listener-supported public radio for the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. And we're able to bring you shows like this local show because of your support. And we're going to turn now to one of our first guests. The Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River is a unit of the National Park Service designated under the National Wild and Scenic Rivers System. It stretches along 73.4 miles of the Delaware River and protects the outstanding scenic, recreational, cultural, and fish and wildlife resources there. On Thursday, the Upper Delaware Council will host a public presentation titled National Park Service Goals and Staffing, a 2024 update at 7 at the Upper Delaware Council office, which is in Narrowsburg. There's also a virtual link. The National Park Service Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River Superintendent Lindsay Kernath will discuss the agency's near-term goals and objectives within the river corridor, and she joins us now for a preview. Lindsay, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here, and thanks for the work you're doing on the Upper Delaware. What are some of those long near-term goals and objectives within the river corridor for the National Park Service that you're going to talk about on Thursday?
Yeah, absolutely. Our goals for the near term really track with everything we've been trying to do throughout what I would say is a really successful 40-plus year experiment since Congress established the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River in 1978. So our vision for our park unit is to be recognized as a unit of the national park system with unparalleled resource quality sustained through collaboration with dedicated park stewards. So one of the things that's really special about the Upper Delaware is that when Congress created us, they said that we were going to be partnership-focused from day one of the 55,000-plus acres of land within the corridor, only 30 acres of federal land. All of the rest of it is privately owned or owned by other stakeholders. So working with our partners is an incredibly important thing for us here within the corridor. So really making sure that we're investing in those strategic partnerships is one of our key objectives over the coming years. We're also hoping to make sure that the local community and partners understand and positively value the protection of the river like we've been doing since 1978. We also want to make sure that the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River and our partners are leveraging all of our available resources to promote and protect the river's outstandingly remarkable values, which are all those things, the scenic qualities, the geology, the fish, all of that you just listed in the opening.
Yeah, and the Upper Delaware Council is one of your partners who are hosting this presentation as well. And there's so many people that are so invested in protecting this beautiful natural resource. There was a strategic plan that the Park Service had that ended, and now what are some of the planning efforts that are helping to maintain this momentum toward meeting the vision you just outlined.
Yes. So just one note. So the 2020 action plan took us through 2024.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry.
Actionless, right? I don't.
Right. Sorry.
We've been just wandering about. So we have had a plan kind of put in place. But if we all think back to where we were in 2019, 2020, that was pre-COVID. A lot of things changed. The world changed. Like, there was a lot of things that we just simply couldn't get done in the same way that we had expected. So what we've been, and there also has been a significant number of staffing and institutional knowledge changes here within our staff with the National Park Service, and also on the Upper Delaware Council, too. We've had quite a bit of turnover in some of the staff members. So I would say we're in a bit of a rebuilding time. We've gone back. We've looked at things like that 2020 to 2024 strategic action plan with our current team, tried to come up with actions that really work for us for the next several years while we put our time into figuring out what the next 5 or 10 years is really going to look like for us. So right now that's been a lot of internal work and internal conversation and getting things on paper and making sure that we've got some ideas that track with the staff and the skills that we have today. And I'd say everything we've come up with is really not that wildly different, as I said, from what we've been doing since 1978. I think about strategic planning, especially in National Park Service units where we're really in the forever business, as kind of like orienteering, right? When you're out there and you're looking at your map and you've got your compass, you know, you set your general direction, but you need to keep checking in to make sure that you haven't, you know, gone just a few degrees off course. So I'd say that's mostly what we're doing right now, is looking back at that 2020 plan, seeing, okay, how far did we get? We know we hit some hurdles and had some changes and challenges along the way. But, you know, what do we need to do to kind of tweak and get us back on track? Or where do we actually need to chart maybe a slightly different course to achieve some of those objectives?
You mentioned some of the staffing challenges. Are there resource challenges as well in terms of funding to achieve these objectives that you're trying to overcome?
So a vast majority of our funding comes directly from Congress. We also charge some nominal fees for operators doing business on the river, for people seeking to get what we call special use permits, like you want to have your wedding. You know, we get a little bit of money there, but almost all of our money comes directly from Congress. And, you know, our other major resources are our partners. Like you said, the Upper Delaware Council, all of our other partnerships throughout the corridor, that's really where we have to look to get our work done and try and leveraging all of those connections so that we can extend our reach even further. So, I mean, as far as our budget goes, every year the president submits a budget request to Congress for each federal agency. The National Park Service budget, so Upper Delaware's budget, is included in what the Park Service calls the Green Book. And that's where you're going to see all of our budget requests for the entire national park system. And I will say one of the key requests you will see in every Green Book is our comptroller and her budget team are always requesting to get some of our operational fixed costs covered. You know, we've all been talking a lot about inflation. You know, just costs do just keep going up for folks, and the same thing applies to us. So, but, you know, the reality is, Congress has some tough decisions to make, and those subcommittees need to figure out where all of our hard-earned taxpayer dollars go. So it's a tough competitive environment. So here at Upper Delaware, we're just working to do our best and achieve our goals within our existing resources and really working strategically with all of the wonderful partners we have out there throughout our 73 miles of river.
Yeah, the president's budget was a proposal of $3.57 billion for the entire National Park Service, not just for Upper Delaware. But do you know where that process is in terms of Congress? Are they still marking it up?
Yes, we have not received an update. Around this time of year, you know, the 25 budget has gone in and Congress has it. The subcommittees are working on it. So, you know, we're always optimistic that by the time we get to September 30th, we'll have a new budget to chart the path forward starting on October 1st. So we remain optimistic and are confident that Congress is going to do their job.
Do you feel like you're getting support from local representatives, congressional representatives, and other representatives to get that?
Absolutely. You know, I think the Park Service is generally a fairly... people I will say one of the things I love most about working for the National Park Service is everybody I meet, whether it's somebody in Congress or just one of our visitors, everybody likes to tell you about their national park experience. So I think the members of Congress who are working really hard to get us an appropriation, I think we have goodwill in the national park system, and it's just the federal government has a lot of things that we're trying to spend money on. So, but as representatives need information, that our budget office coordinates all that and gets information up to those folks whenever they need it. And locally, I'd say we feel very supportive.
Let's remind folks about your presentation on Thursday at the UDC Upper Delaware Council, the Park Service Goals and Staffing Update. Where can folks get more information? If they can't make it in person, they can join by Zoom. Where could they get more info?
You can go to the UDC's website. The UDC, the Upper Delaware Council, puts their meeting minutes online, so you could probably read some kind of summary that their staff will have put up after the meeting. You can also go to our website, which is nps.gov/UPDE, and find out a little bit more. Our goals in this presentation aren't going to be posted there, but you can at least learn more about the part about us as a river and what we're doing. You can follow us on social media. We have a really fantastic social media team who's been pushing out some pretty entertaining videos on Instagram and Facebook. And then lastly, if anybody wants to come just talk to us and find out what's going on, we are hosting the Zane Grey Festival in Lackawaxen this coming Saturday from 10 to 4, open to the public. It's free, all kinds of family fun. And I'll be there for at least a few hours. So if you can't make it Thursday, you can catch me Saturday morning.
you're here all week.
I'm here all week.
Also, before we go, just a good time to remind folks about the river. It's hot. It's summer. People are in the river cooling off. Wear your life jacket, wear your life vest.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, wear a properly fitting life vest. You know, even if you're going for a swim, that's unfortunately where we have people get into the most trouble. You know, they think we all grew up swimming in pools and, peaceful water, but really this river, while it might look peaceful, it's always moving. So please wear a properly fitted life jacket, whether you're in a boat, if you're going swimming, do it for you, do it for your family. We all want you to have a wonderfully safe, wonderful and safe experience. We want you to be able to come back. So, yes, please be careful and wear your life jacket when you're out there on the river.
And to check on river conditions there, you can call the Upper Delaware River Hotline, 845-252-7100. It's available 24 hours a day, 845-252-7100, or go online to nps.gov/UPDE. Lindsay Kurnath, Superintendent of the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate being on.
Okay, we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll go a little further upriver to Hancock and the Friends of the Upper Delaware River to talk about their River Fest coming up. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Lauren Migaki. I'm a coordinating producer for NPR. A coordinating producer is someone who goes in the fields wherever there's a big news event happening and acts as event planner and scheduler and script proofreader. Often it just means you're the problem solver on the ground. So anything that the reporters need to do their job, you're kind of there to help with. You know, the beauty of it is that you get to support people who are telling people stories that you can't get if you're not on the ground. Making sure that they have power strips and showers, things like that, it feels like you're part of this bigger team effort to help tell the story. I think it's so important to have eyes and ears on something as small as a school board vote to as large as a global conflict. There's a lot that goes into reporting a story that doesn't always get seen, but is crucial to doing the story, and we could not do that without listener donations.
Keep public radio in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Or call us at 845-482-4141. It's our summer fun drive. We're being cool for the summer. We can only stay cool with your support, 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Friends of the Upper Delaware River celebrates the river and what it means for the people and communities that live in the watershed. And they're celebrating that with their second annual River Fest this Saturday at 10 in Deposit. For more information, let's check in with Jeff Skelding, president of Friends of the Upper Delaware. He joins us live. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so this is the second annual River Fest. It went well enough last year that you're bringing it back. What can folks expect?
Yeah, it's we're trying to make this an annual event, and as you know, Friends of the Upper Delaware River is the full-time advocacy voice for the river, and we feel like it deserves a celebration, and so we're moving it around every year. Last year we were up in Downsville. It was a little cold in the fall, so we decided to do it a little warmer, time of the year, and we have all kinds of events going on, and really it's just what it says it is. It's a celebration of a river that provides so much to so many people, both locally and the burgeoning tourism economy that it generates. And so we thought we'd set a day aside and invite folks to come on up to deposit.
So you've got crafts for kids, other activities, food and drink, and also you've got other local organizations and conservation organizations that are going to be there, too, to give out some information.
Right. This year we got a bunch of our friends to help out with sponsorships, like the New York League of Conservation Boaters and some of our local governments and our local nonprofit associations. And it's really just we hope that it continues to grow like that, because it's not just FUDR sponsoring and hosting. It's to protect a river, you need lots of friends. And so we get more and more people helping us, we hope, with each passing year.
Yeah, we just had on Lindsay Kerneth, the superintendent of the National Park Service, to talk about the presentation they're doing this Thursday and their expectations and goals moving forward. And we're talking about all the stakeholders along the river corridor. And just talk a little bit about how important that is to, benefit all of the communities and people that enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, the Upper Delaware River is a really gem of a natural resource in New York State and the East Coast. And it provides so much to so many people. It generates local economy. It provides world-class angling opportunities. As times get tough around the country with climate change, we have this system that's fueled by this cold water, tailwater system from New York City's reservoirs. It's always going to be, we hope anyway, cold and clean. And, it's a destination river for all kinds of people. And, so this is as you said, watershed protection requires multiple stakeholders. So this is both everywhere from local residents to local governments to people that visit here, our second homes here, and everywhere in between.
Just coming off this 4th of July holiday weekend and I don't know if it's the beginning of summer, it's a lot of folks around, I can say that. Are you seeing a lot more folks out there on the river enjoying the river?
Yeah, I mean every year we are seeing that, for the most part we think that's a good thing. It does create a little more pressure. It does require a little more river etiquette and people thinking more about making sure that the increasing usage of the river is not resulting in increasing degradation. And so, I mean, generally speaking, we feel like a river is for everybody, and the more you expose people to it, the stronger, we hope, the conservation ethic is going to be around it. We also have to take care to be respectful of other people that are using the river and to be respectful of the ecological quality that the entire watershed provides.
Yeah, and it provides so much to so many. And you mentioned about the reservoir levels, the release rates. Can you talk a little bit about what the current release rates are right now and how that impacts conditions?
Yeah, a lot of folks don't know that the entire system is very much impacted by how the city of New York manages their three big reservoirs, the Cannonsville, the Papacton, and the Neversink reservoirs. They have a lot, how much water is going down to the city for water supply and how much water is being released from those reservoirs down the river. And the habitat of the river relies heavily on that system. Thankfully, we have a pretty good system. We're in the summertime releases now, which are reasonably reasonable levels that, satisfy most of the people that use the river, particularly if you're in a boat or if you're angling. We have had some recent challenges with the heat, and that might be, a harbinger of things to come. We have to keep an eye on that. But, it is a cold water ecosystem because of those reservoirs, and that's been that way for probably about 70 years now. And so when the heat comes that kind of upsets the apple cart a little bit, and we have to make sure the reservoir management is accommodating for that.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the link on the website that goes to the NYC Environmental Protection site, which has current data as of July 5th. And it just shows that you know, how big of an impact this is. The consumption as of July 4th was 1.09 billion gallons of water in New York City. And it also mentions about, you know, total storage and precipitation. It looks as if the storage is slightly down from normal rates, and the precipitation in July is slightly down as well, according to historical rates. Any concerns there?
Well, it's interesting you're looking at those numbers. This is a bit of a different year because they've got a huge project that will start in the fall and last for about 8 months to actually shut down the tunnel that takes water from the three reservoirs of the Delaware system. So that's causing some very different management practices here. So yes, they are diverting, which means taking water from the reservoirs and sending it to New York City and surrounding counties, because come October 1st, they're going to be shutting down those diversions. So they're working their whole system here. They're hitting the Delaware system hard now, which is why you're seeing that higher number, and allowing their other systems in the Catskills and the west of Hudson, Catskills, and down the Croton system to build up. So they'll have water for when they shut down that aqueduct on October 1st. So that's the reason for the slightly different numbers, but, you know, so far so good in terms of, you know, the way they are, we feel like the way they are preparing for that project.
It's just amazing to think how connected this all is. You know, you see the river, like, you know, outside as you're enjoying it here, and then just understanding how all of the reservoirs and rivers and everything so complicated and intertwined to provide that drinking water to the most populous city in the States. If you want to find out more about those levels, you can go to FUDR.org and click on river conditions to see it. I'm kind of fascinated by it. But meanwhile, let's remind folks how they can get more information about the Riverfest that's coming up on Saturday.
Yeah, we'll be sending out an announcement again this week, a couple of them probably. And you can go to FUDR.org to learn more. And as you said, it's from 10 o'clock to 3 o'clock in Deposit, New York, place we call the community, or it's referred to as the community park, and it's at 20 Borden, B-O-R-D-E-N Street in Deposit, New York.
And there's going to be a kids conservation corner as well, focusing on conservation for the younger folks.
Yes, absolutely. That's the future of the river, of course, and we need to always be cultivating and nurturing a new generation of river stewards. That's a big part of the theme here.
All right, Jeff Skelding is president of the Friends of the Upper Delaware. The Riverfest is coming up this Saturday at 10 in Deposit. Jeff, have a great Riverfest. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we'll take a break. And when we come back, local economic perspective from James B. Huntington. This is Radio Chatskill.
The fight against disinformation is more complicated than ever. And in a record year for elections around the world, it's never been more important. I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. At NPR and this station, we report rigorously on the forces trying to disrupt democracy and provide your community with reliable information. This election year, stand with the facts. Donate to this station today.
Give now at WJFFradio.org. Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
And your donations are crucial to our success to be able to bring you all of the great local news, culture, and NPR that you hear every day here. So support us during our summer fun drive. We just kicked off officially the on-air portion of it this morning at 7, but we're already on our way. We've got about 13% of our goal met already. That's great. We just need to get to the rest of it. It's a $50,000 goal. We're going to make that by July 20th, but we could make it even sooner if we hear from you. 845-482-4141 or go to WJFFradio.org. Another cool thing is you can support our locally produced shows, our locally produced content, and all of the dedicated volunteers who create it by making your donation in honor of your favorite show. If you click donate now, just scroll down. You'll see the whole list of all of the great, great shows that we bring you here on Radio Catskill that you can't hear anywhere else. So Support that, support us, and thank you. You're listening to Radio Chatscale, and it's Monday. That means it's time to check in with a local economist, author James B. Huntington, for some local economic perspective on Work Shift Live. Good morning, James B.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Right, working 9 to 5, I guess appropriate because Friday there was a big jobs report that came out. What can you tell us about that?
Well, we got 206,000 more net new non-farm payroll positions, which was very close to what a couple people predicted that I saw. We had unemployment, though, went up 0.1%. This is the seasonally adjusted variety. Went up 0.1% to 4.1% with 200,000 more unemployed. We have long-term unemployed people up 100,000 to 1.5 million. That's been creeping up for a year now, not really noticed, along with the unemployment rate. Then we have labor force participation up 0.1% at 62.6. So lots of people joined the labor force, even though a lot of them didn't get jobs. We have the employment population ratio still at 60.1%. That's the best indicator of whether people are actually working in this country. And it's staying the same, around 60%. You can remember that. Okay. We dropped 200,000 from the count of people who are working part-time for economic reasons or looking for full-time jobs while keeping part-time ones. And what was also a news item, non-farm private payroll earnings went up 9 cents an hour. That's a little over inflation, but it's lower than it has been. It's at $35 even now. The American job shortage number, or AJSN, showing how many additional positions could be quickly filled if everyone knew they would be easy to get, went up 17.3 million, showing that latent demand, that's where it's at now, it went up almost 500,000, showing that latent demand for jobs is still quite strong and, in fact, has been going up. So all in all, yes, although we got the new jobs, they seem to go to people who are not just unemployed, a lot of people who are just getting in the job market for the first time in a while or ever. So more people are trying. We have latent demand alive and well, but increasing. But one thing that affected some of these numbers, any of the seasonally unadjusted one, was that June is a tougher month. A lot of people lose part-time or seasonal jobs in May, and so they don't have as many. So overall, all in all, this was a decent month. We're not in as good shape as we were 6 months or a year ago, but overall we're doing well.
Yeah, so it exceeded expectations, I guess, given that you said, you know, June is a little bit slower in some ways. It's the 42nd consecutive month of job growth, but with these unemployment rising, does that signal that maybe the labor market's cooling a little bit?
Yes, it is, and we're getting other commentary and things being discussed about that it is describable as cooling. It's still tight. That's also a word that's being used. There are not a lot of people out there looking for work. The number has been creeping up, but it's still on the low side. And one thing we're seeing is that there are investors who are now commenting and speculating to some extent that a couple more months like this and there's going to be an interest rate cut, which is the kind of thing they want. So everything has been just in a good place for the previous 6 months of this year. But if unemployment gets a little higher, 4.2, 4.3%, or something, even without regard to how many new jobs, because latent demand is so strong anyway that the jobs will be absorbed one way or another. But if we get unemployment higher and we get wages continuing to go slowly down or increase less, I should say, it's not, it's according to wages, it's not a super high demand time for employees. If we get these things, then we may see slightly lower interest rates. So we don't know, but it's possible that in September it will happen.
That's sort of the effect that the report had on investors. We don't know what the effect that it had on the Fed, but it doesn't seem as if there's maybe a sense of urgency there for them to cut the rates.
No, well, as I was saying, it's people commenting about interest rates are going to go down in a few months. They can't possibly know that because it says it's a result of the situation we're in now, and anything can happen in a jobs report. And if things continue to cool down, if it looks like lowering interest rates would be okay, but the interest rates now, frankly, are right where they should be given how conditions are now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's.
And it's also not going to be any huge change. We're talking about a quarter of a percent or something.
Right.
Most likely, don't look for a full point cut or anything. It's unless unemployment or employment, I should say, really goes down the sewer in the next couple months, and there's no reason for that.
So this is where we are now. So let's look back a little bit. Is the labor market nearing pre-pandemic conditions?
Yes, that's exactly what a report came out with. Huntington Private Bank, no relation, came out with a significant report that was passed along to Congress. And they were saying they used the phrases I just mentioned, tight but not overheated, to describe it. And the balance between labor demand and supply appears similar to that in the period immediately before the pandemic, when unemployment was a little higher than it was a year ago or something. We're talking before the pandemic. We're talking, of course, about 2019 or maybe very early 2020. So it's they're reiterating the Federal Reserve chair is saying that there might be an interest rate cut later this year. So it's described as tight but not overheated. So no one's saying it's too high. So there's certainly no pressure to raise interest rates, which could be the case if unemployment was going down even lower and lower, and inflation, which is 2.6% by the measure they like to use, is above 2%, but not much. And it does not have much similarity to the 9% we saw a couple of years ago. So if inflation goes down a little, it has been going down about 0.1% a month for a while. It goes down a little ignore the new jobs, but unemployment goes up a little bit and wages stay, let's say, no more than about 4% a month, or 4% a year, rather, average here. If all of that happens, yes, it's we're going to be really looking at lower interest rates and a general view that it's the same as it was before the pandemic scrambled everything up.
Got it. You've got another news item here. What a change, a big change that's happened in the toy business?
Yes, it's moving along. It's been happening, but it's the big word for a lot of toy sellers now is nostalgia, and they are selling a lot of things to grown-ups. In the categories they use to figure out the market for selling toys, people 18 and over is actually larger than any of the groups of children they have now. more than 3 to 5 year olds, for example. So what they're selling is vintage toys and sometimes new versions of vintage toys. Adults are buying them to collect, to resell, to sell to other adults, and some of them are doing very well.
Wow.
It's a prime area for a hobby or a side hustle that can turn into a full-time job. So some of the biggest categories right now are Lego, action figures, especially certain G.I. Joes, trading cards, Polly Pockets, Hot Wheels, and Transformer action figures. And then you have the whole thing of Lego, which is really kind of a continuous. There are people of any age you care to mention in this country, substantial numbers of them who like Lego. So it's almost a continuous thing. But the children are getting smaller sets and things that are more simple and such. And grown-ups are really the target market for some of the large sets they have. It's possible to spend $500 on a Lego set that's designed to make a specific design that you will put together. And the people buying these are not children.
Wow. So, I better go check my attic. I think I had some Legos when I was a kid.
You might. There are a lot of collectibles out there. But, of course, the more that got saved and the better condition they're in, the not so valuable they'll be. But it's actually getting to be a problem in the business, something they're talking about. Some companies are focusing so much on nostalgia, like Mattel. I didn't mention Barbie, which is one of the biggest, most popular toys for all ages going on around now. The problem they're having, some of them are seeing, is that if they focus so much on adults, they're not going to have children buying things and wanting them when they become adults as much. If they're not going to be as interesting, or if so many of the toys they're making are too expensive for people to buy for most children, then it's going to be a problem if they don't have this natural thing of selling to children and then continuing to sell to them. If they become interested in toys when they're adults, they may be eating their seed corn, so to speak. So it's all this, yes. So it's one of these things. When you think about somebody who gets a job, it's generally not someone who's unemployed. 2/3 of jobs have been going to people who were not officially unemployed, and it may be the same sort of thing when you think about who they're selling toys to. It's a lot of the time it is grown-ups, and that's not unusual.
I guess that jingle came true. I don't want to grow up. I'm a Toys R Us kid.
Well, that's about it. I mean, people have great memories of those times. And, I mean, why not go out and buy some toys that you couldn't afford or you coveted when you were a child, and you can just pay money and go out and buy it now or keep doing it, even if you don't do a lot with them? I mean, it's really hard to blame people for doing that, as I see it.
Well, how did the numbers grow or not grow last week's stock, oil, metal, and all the prices from this morning as well? How'd they change?
Okay, early this morning, gold was $2,371 an ounce. That's up $43. That's an all-time high, or awfully close. I think it was $2,400, but we're a good day or so away from having an all-time high there. Silver, $30.87. That's up $1.70. Even better, the ratio there between silver and gold is 77-1, which is on the low side by recent standards because silver's been doing well. Dow Jones Industrial Average, $39,376. That's up $257. That's a strong week, if not really a huge one. But NASDAQ, 18,353, all-time high or very close, plus 620. The tech stocks are doing better and better. It's interesting because I'm hearing a lot of scuttlebutt about, there may be an AI bubble bursting and there may be prices on certain stocks, NVIDIA and Apple, or and Google and similar things may really be headed for a crash, but it's not happening yet, and they're looking stronger and stronger. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $82.56 the barrel, up 65 cents. That's just sort of normal increasing for the summer with higher demand, Northern Hemisphere anyway. Bitcoin, 57,845. That's a drop of 5,000. It seems to be in trouble. It's not, it got out of its 60s rut in the wrong direction. So watch out. It has gone up and down like a roller coaster over the last 5 years, and it's zooming in a scary and exciting way downhill right now. British pound, 1.2814, up 1.32 cents. It's remarkable. They must like their new prime minister. Euro, 1.0847, up 79 hundredths. That's a solid gain there. Japanese, 100 yen, still at 62 cents, staying in the dumper. Overall, all the changes except Bitcoin, I read you, were plus. They went up in value, so we're getting more and more demand and more money around to get allow people to buy them. So that's what prices were this past week.
All right, that sounds like some good local economic perspective from our good friend James B. Huntington with Workship Live. Working 9 to 5. James B., thank you so much. We'll see you next Monday.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
All right. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Harmony in the Woods is welcoming the Lau Tizer Band. They're making their debut at the Festival for Live Music this Friday. We'll talk to Lau Tizer after this break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Imagine one day your NPR station just disappeared. All the news and shows and conversations that you love, gone. Well, we have been thinking about some backup plans. Maybe Corva Coleman could read AI-generated poetry?
Potato clouds drift in a spud-filled sea in this absurd world where I roam free.
Or maybe Steve Inskeep could do some ASMR?
I'm here to guide you through a calming journey into the heart of nature.
Or Scott Simon could read the dictionary.
Oh, here's a good one. Gongoozler. That's somebody who enjoys watching activity on canals. Ha! I'm a gongoozler.
Actually, I would listen to Scott Simon reading the dictionary. But you rely on public radio for so much more every day. So please, help us make sure those backup plans stay on the shelf. You can support this station today.
Here's how to donate.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Harmony in the Woods is the outdoor amphitheater nestled in the forests of Holly, and they have live music and curated performances every summer with regional and national performing artists of all genres. Jazz Group of the Year nominee, the Lau Tizer Band, will make their debut at Harmony in the Woods Friday in support of their forthcoming summer 2024 album and video release, Amplify. Let's take a listen to some of that. It's Down.
I'm not tripping down this road. Someone who's lost their way back home. You've made it very clear. Can't find your way back, no.
And that is music from the Lau Tizer Band. And joining us right now is Lau Tizer. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tim. How are you? Good to chat with you.
Good. Good to chat with you, too. That was Down, your current single. And I was playing that from the video, and the great thing about this video is it's all shot in studio. You guys are performing this live, and the vocals there from Elliot Yamin and the rest of the team there, it's such a cool experience being in there live. What was it like sort of, you know, having this filmed as you're doing it?
Oh, yeah, it was, well, first of all, to do a project in that way is, of course, kind of adds to the footprint of it, right? So just to record an album, if you're going to do it all live like we did, is one thing. And then to add 7 cameras into that mix, all in the same room, and to accomplish both at once is definitely an ambitious undertaking and also super fun. I mean, we did the whole album, all 9 songs, live in 2 days. So once we were off and rolling, it was great. And I think on the second day, a bunch of those songs were like the first or second take. And, you know, I'm lucky to work with a really outstanding group of musicians across the board. And yeah, I mean, you know, you spend months and months conceiving the concept for it and tweaking and planning and whatever. And then to get, you know, when it comes to life, and then when I, you know, when you get the first video edit, so you see what, you know, at least the start of what happened, it's a very gratifying process. And also, one that requires a lot of tenacity. It's a long road. So,
yeah, I mean, congratulations to you. I mean, a 7 camera video shoot, shooting this all, recording and filming this live, really great thing to do. But there's got to be a little bit of nerves there, like everybody hitting their mark, hitting their notes, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the reasons, so we recorded it actually the 2 days after my birthday last October, so October 2nd and 3rd. So we had been on tour, like super busy all summer. And a couple of reasons why I scheduled it then was that it was like we had had all these shows under our belt. So all the tunes were in the live show already, even the new stuff. And so there's no better rehearsal than just performing live on different stages for audiences, tweaking, letting the songs evolve and grow. And so by the time we got to the studio, I mean, everybody was so inside the music and they're all really good. So yes, of course, there's always that thing of making sure everybody plays, you know, plays right. But really, I have the utmost respect and, you know, and trust for everybody. They're all, you know, on the album, there's like, I don't know, 3 or 4 Grammy winners, a Grammy nominee, a 3-time Emmy winner. Of course, Elliot was a, you know, big star on Idol. So really like top flight, you know, musicians and friends. And yeah, it was a fun project, man, but not one that I would undertake more than every few years. So
yeah,
it's a lot of work, especially I have my wife and we have a 2-year-old at home, which while I was preparing for the record was closer to 18 months. Wow. And so it was a full plate, but I'm super proud of it. And so far the response to Down has been great. So, lots more music to come, of course.
Yeah, I want to ask you about your influences and your start. You are the self-described, quote, child of East Coast Jewish hippies. So they had a great musical taste that influenced you. And instead of going to music school, you kind of went right into working with bands. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, so I studied my dad, actually, on my dad's side, my great-grandfather, who I never met when I was old enough to remember him. I did meet him when I was a baby, but I don't have a memory of that. He was a piano teacher from back in Russia. So that was kind of the only musical lineage, actually, on either side of my family. It didn't really come from a musical family, but my grandparents on my dad's side especially were definitely kind of like socialites and enjoyed the arts and classical music and all that. And my dad grew up in the Philly area, so they went to a lot of the, like, you know, sophisticated stuff there. And then I started lessons just before I turned 9. And of course, like most pianists, started with classical music. I always improvised. I always composed my own music. It was probably like my most natural gift. And then, yeah, I mean, when I got my first keyboard, the deal with my parents, I was 14, was that, you know, because we had a piano at home, and I loved good music store and play, like in those days, it was like a Yamaha, Clavinova, whatever, because it just had other sounds. It was exciting to me. So they agreed to loan me the money for my first keyboard and pay them back. So to pay them back, I started performing, and that's how I paid them back. And then people asked me to make a, in those years, it was a cassette. It was 1993. I was a freshman in high school. And so I made my first self-produced, like, cassette and sold it at shows. And by the time I graduated high school, I was just releasing my third, like, solo keyboard album. And the path kind of laid itself out to me. So, yeah, I never went to music school. I moved to L.A. about 6 months after I graduated high school. My first manager found me playing in Denver. And brought me out here. And then it just kind of went on from there. And really, honestly, just working with musicians who were better, more experienced, more seasoned, really just kind of, you know, whips you into shape, I guess I would say. I mean, if you're going to be on the bandstand with, you know, people like Eric Marienthal, who's a multiple Grammy winner, who's in the group, you know, Eric's an amazing saxophone, like, legend. So if you're going to be on the bandstand and play with a guy like that when it's your turn to solo, you better be able to bring it. And there's no better way to kind of learn that and to be pushed to grow that way than to just have, you know, have it happen live and working, you know, with your peers and learning and growing and expanding your horizons. So yeah, it's not maybe the most traditional path that a lot of people take, but that's the path that it took for me. And certainly there's lots of great artists who have done the same.
Well, was this like living school for you that, you know, and you say in your bio, you got your butt kicked on the bandstand by these musicians who were more experienced. I think it's really cool. Your journey here too. Also a nugget here that I saw in your bio that you grew up with everything but jazz and you didn't discover that until you were a teenager. And now you're in this, jazz group that's Jazz Group of the Year nominee.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I mean, for anybody who's an instrumentalist, I'm not a singer. I mean, of course I composed and co-wrote all the original vocals on the album, but for an instrumentalist, like if you're going to be an improviser and a composer, jazz ends up being such a natural place to end up today. So my dad wasn't into jazz. Like I grew up with like classical music, you know, my parents were baby boomers. So the music of, you know, of their childhood, Buddy Holly, Sam Cooke, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, the Beatles, Stones, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I wasn't really exposed to jazz. It wasn't until high school that I got into it. And then it just kind of opened a whole new set of horizons. And really what the group does now, especially with the Amplify project coming out, it's so crossover. I mean, it's like jazz, R&B, there's a bit of funk, there's a bit of world. It's definitely hybrid, somewhat genre defying. And I think that's worked really well for us. I mean, audiences enjoy the variety of flavors we bring, and it also kind of makes it accessible to a broader audience, which is important to me as well.
Well, you'll be making that debut at Harmony in the Woods this Friday. It's the quartet of the band, not the full band, but great experience. Yeah. So there's more information about that at harmonyinthewoods.org to get ticket information. And then there's more information about Lau and his background in the band and everything, all the music at lautizer.com. That's lautizer.com. Thank you so much for joining us and have a great time at Harmony in the Woods. We appreciate you being here this morning.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Tim. And yeah, we're looking forward to it. It looks like a beautiful setting. And being from Colorado, the outdoor kind of amphitheater vibes are always right up my alley. So we're all excited and hope to see lots of your listeners' faces there.
All right, thanks. Very cool. What also is cool is our summer fun drive. We are starting it off today. We are on our way. We're cool for the summer here. Help us stay cool by donating to your favorite radio station, your favorite local station, bringing you all the great local news, culture, and NPR that you hear here. Donate at 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. Make a donation of any amount. Keep us strong. We can only do it with you and your support. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hi, I'm Valerie Mansey. I report on local arts and culture for Radio Catskill. And talking with these creative people keeps me up to date on current trends. For instance, this summer, all the cool people are supporting public radio. That's right. The in thing is to keep the radio on. Don't miss out. Be cooler than ever this summer by keeping Radio Catskill on air. Give now at wjffradio.org.
That's right, Val. Be cool. You want to stay in. It's a little humid today, and you're going to stay that way for a few days, too. Sunshine mixing with clouds. Very warm. Can't rule out an afternoon thunderstorm, high of 87. And then looking forward to Wednesday, not looking forward, but looking ahead to Wednesday morning and late Wednesday night, we might get some of the effects of tropical rainstorm Beryl. WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. It's Radio Catskill.